You're listening to episode 357 of the Building Psychological Strength podcast. I'm your host, Dr. April Seifert. On this podcast, we uncover the information, tools, and techniques to turn our mind into our most valuable asset. Hey everyone, welcome back to the podcast. I'm so thrilled to have you here, and I am especially thrilled to have you here for today's episode. We're diving into a topic that is very important given the situation and world that we're all living in. You know, we've been through a lot. I feel like I say that almost every episode because you think back to the last, you know, handful of years, and it's not just the pandemic, it's everything that's happened politically, everything that's happened economically, societally. It's a lot. We've all gone through a lot. And, you know, I was chatting with Ashley Smith, Dr. Ashley, the co-founder of mine in Peak Mind, and she was talking about how she is so incredibly busy. She was really busy through the entire summer. And it's not common for her, you know, back to school time for what she does. She does anxiety counseling, and she's a, you know, a therapist who specializes in anxiety and other related things. Back to school time tends to be busy, but not in the summer. And I talked to other counselors and other therapists who had the same experience. They're just busy. And it's an indicator of where we're at as a society. We're just struggling. We're having a hard time. And it's amazing that we're reaching out. I mean, holy cow. Thankfully, you know, we have people to turn to like therapists and counselors and social workers that we can speak with. So one thing I just want to say right out of the gate, everybody should have a therapist that they can call up. Do the work to shop around and find somebody that you have rapport with, who seems to jive with you and understand you, who you feel comfortable with, because it makes it a lot easier to call that person in and work with that person when you're in a difficult situation, when you don't have to go seek them out and like search around for them. So big tip that I have for all of you is just have somebody that you have an established relationship with, even if it isn't a big thing that you need right now, because eventually you're going to need it. And it's so nice to have that person in your back pocket. Now, that being said, therapy and what we do inside a counseling or therapist's office is only one way that we support mental health and well-being. And I think we're all seeing that really clearly these days. So today's topic is related to other ways we can support mental health and well-being, and ways that we individually can impact the mental health and well-being of other people around us. So today we're talking about psychological safety. You hear this topic talked about a lot in corporate settings, in team settings, sometimes in like close relationships. So when we're talking about romantic relationships, you hear this topic talked about a lot there as well. And basically the importance of us cultivating an environment inside those relationships, whether it's a professional team or an interpersonal relationship with a friend or a family member or a loved one, where we feel safe in having disagreements, you know, expressing our needs, setting boundaries, failing, where we feel like that is something that we can do without experiencing retaliation. So today's topic is one that is absolutely critical for us to all learn about and focus on because it impacts some of the most important relationships in our lives and ultimately impacts the mental well-being of those around us. So today we're speaking with Stefan Wiedner. He's a psychological safety expert whose career has focused on developing sustainable high-performance leaders, teams, and organizations. He has a passion for unleashing the collective potential of people, and that has led him to co-found Numi.com, the web's largest network of independent life coaches, Skillsetter.com, the Deliberate Practice Platform for Interpersonal Skills, and Zarango.com, the psychological safety training experts. Stefan has been a guest speaker for ACE Tech, Marketing Impact Council, and many other audiences interested in psychology, business, and tech. His writing's been featured in Forbes, Entrepreneur, and other super fancy places like that. He is married with two kids and loves spending quality time outdoors, hiking, biking, camping, and reading. I loved this conversation with him because we spoke so much about the practicalities of cultivating an environment of psychological safety and also how you might be able to do that even if you're the type of person who, quote, hates conflict. This episode is definitely for you. That's enough blah blah for me. I'm so excited for you all to meet Stefan Wiedner. Let's roll that episode. Stefan, I'm so excited that you're joining us for this episode of the podcast. It's such an important topic, and I don't think we've ever had an expert in this topic on the show. So welcome and thanks for being here.
April, thanks for having me. It's an honor. I appreciate it.
You know, it's funny because I was looking through my notes and the stuff that you submitted to prep for this episode, and I just kept thinking to myself that your topic of psychological safety, especially in the context of where we're at professionally, as a society, the challenges that we've all faced recently, it feels like we're probably very overdue for having this conversation. Would you agree with that?
I definitely think so. I think there's been a bit of a wave of, I wouldn't say quite excitement, or it's, this topic is certainly starting to hit the shore, if you will, like a tsunami. I think more and more people are interested in the topic and see it as fundamental to the success of their organization or their team, et cetera. So yeah, absolutely.
I love it. Can you give us a good foundation? I mean, I feel like we hear the words psychological safety a lot, and especially in like a corporate environment, you hear employers, you know, wanting to know how to generate a culture or create a culture of psychological safety and whatever it is. But I don't think many of us have a very good working definition of what that is and how, like what it actually means in our lives. So can you give us a good foundation of what psych safety is and how it sort of manifests in our lives?
Sure. I'll start with the definition that is provided by Amy Edmondson. So she's a Harvard professor. She's been studying this topic for well over 20 years. And her definition is that psychological safety is a belief that within your team, you can speak up, say what's on your mind, express concerns, admit errors without the fear of reprimand. And so I'll say that again, it's a belief that within your team, you can speak up, say what's on your mind without the fear of reprimand.
That's really great. I think it's worthwhile to pause and ask the audience, how many of you actually feel like that right now? Like if you had to be honest, you don't have to go tell your boss one way or the other, but if you were being honest, do you actually feel that way about your professional life, your closest relationships? Like, holy cow.
Well, what's interesting about it is that it is a team-based construct. And so within an organization, many leaders are, you know, you're, let's say you're the leader of the management or marketing team. So you're in a marketing team, you have direct reports, but you also are part of a management team and where you have more peers. Well, you might feel psychological safety within your own group, but maybe not within another group, or maybe you're in multiple teams, right? Maybe you're, I think everybody can relate to that as well, where there's certain environments where you feel, wow, this is a healthy, comfortable environment. I feel like I can really bring my best self. And then others where maybe you don't. And I think oftentimes we're not even really sure why that is. We just get that feeling, this environment is healthy, this environment maybe not so much, and I don't even know why.
Yeah. It's that intangible aspect of it. And you highlighted the word belief when you were giving that definition. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because it's important, I think, when we think about it being a construct that's sort of shared among people, because there's one side of it where you may think one way, but that doesn't necessarily mean that other person believes the same thing. So can you dive in a little bit on the belief side of this and how that might influence ultimately how a team or an environment feels in terms of its level of psychological safety?
Well, it is a belief. So it's your interpretation. It's how you see it within that environment. And when we measure psychological safety, because that's one of the beauties about it, is that it can be measured rather easily. So there's a 7-question survey that Amy Edmondson created back in 1999 that is still active and being used very regularly today. And it robustly measures this thing called psychological safety, this construct. And when you assess a team, you're going to get a variety of scores. So some people will evaluate and perceive psychological safety as rather low. So that's their belief. They believe in that moment that it's low, and others will think it to be higher, and you get gradients. And so often when we're assessing psychological safety, we as the facilitators get to see all of the details, we get to see all of the scores. And what we share with the teams is just the variability. And what we're hoping for is maybe psychological safety is not super high. Maybe it's not super low. It's in the middle. But there's a big difference between the it being, say, an average score of 75 out of 100, but everybody agrees that it's around that score versus you have a handful of people who think it's 100 and a handful of people who think it's 50. And so that might mean you have kind of this bimodal distribution where half of the people think, I love this team. It's awesome. And then you have some other people who are maybe on the outs. You know, there's like an old school group of people who've been in the team for a long time, so they feel really comfortable. And then there's the newer people, or maybe it's people that are different based on age or different based on whatever other factors might be contributing to the sense of psychological safety. So it's not completely uniform within a team.
I love that. I always feel like I need to use my blinker and let a guest know when I'm about to sort of take a side path, because I think it's an important one. You know, we're talking a lot about these interpersonal pieces and a lot of what impacts beliefs, and you hit it right with that last comment, is our beliefs are impacted by what we individually bring to the table in terms of our past experiences with people or situations, environments that may smell similar to the one that we're in right now, right? They may resemble them. And when you think about, you know, that example you gave where maybe some people are doing well and think that it's a very safe, open environment and others don't, I'm curious if you can talk a little bit about the impact of systemic racism or like social constructs being one thing, but also, so that's kind of on like a macro scale, but then on a micro scale, I can imagine that things like just a person's upbringing and their ability to be trusting in the world could impact the degree to which they could go into any group and feel like they can be authentic. So there's kind of like a macro micro thing there, but I'm wondering if you can just talk a little bit about how that might affect how a person on your team may have a very different perception of the safety of that team.
Oh, that is a tough question.
I feel intimidated.
Oh my goodness. What I do know about psychological safety is when you assess it, like I said, there's seven questions. And one of those questions is, it's not really a question, it's more of a, you want to have people answer how true the statement feels for them. So people on this, the first one of them is, people on this team always accept others for being different. And so that to me points to diversity and inclusivity and recognizing that people are different. And there's another question relating to diversity and inclusion out of the seven, which is, my unique skills and talents are valued and utilized by members of this team.
Yeah.
So isn't that incredible? We're talking about psychological safety, and yet two out of seven questions are almost directly related to how someone shows up and feels different and unique and appreciated within their team. And so for the growing number of teams that are out there that are multicultural, multi-geographic, right? We have all these remote teams now. My team, I have someone in Australia, I have someone on the East Coast, someone on the West Coast, and they have different ethnic backgrounds and so on. We want to embrace all of the differences so that everybody who's showing up at work can feel like they can bring their best selves. Now, you were asking a question, April, about people who perhaps have felt marginalized their whole lives, mm-hmm. and their experience within the team will be shaped by those previous experiences. And I think that's where these interpersonal skills come in, where as a leader or as a teammate, you want to be so particularly attuned to how those people are feeling within the team so that you can approach it in a way that is constructive, and you're not just pretending like we're all the same color and we all have the same backgrounds and, you know, this color blindness that might feel like the right solution for people.
Yeah, that's so good. I would love to go there and talk a little bit about that interpersonal, like set of interpersonal skills that you referenced, because, you know, you can imagine Part of the reason why I'm pushing on this topic a little bit is what I studied in my dissertation work was the impact of like our social groups. So typically I did a lot in gender, but a lot in race and ethnicity as well, and how those experiences and how we have in sometimes in large ways and other times more often even in subtle ways, how we've been treated and welcomed into, or sometimes in like marginalized in certain circumstances, it just impacts the way that we interact in really any relationship going forward. And I think we're all getting more aware of the fact that there's a lot that we may not realize because we each only have our own background, right? Like we only have direct experience with our own experiences. So that does point to your point, a set of interpersonal skills that allow us to maybe expand beyond what we've directly experienced and be a little bit more open to what other people might be bringing to the table. So can you talk a little bit about what that set of interpersonal skills is, how it helps cultivate psychological safety?
Sure. Maybe I'll start with a little bit of the science that has informed our work and then try to make it a little bit more practical. I don't want to bore people with, you know, the academic research, but I'm confident I won't be able to do that because I'm not really an academic or a researcher myself. I appreciate it. Yeah. So first of all, I'll back up a little bit. I started my career in coaching, leadership coaching over 15 years ago. And so that's been a big foundation for the work that I've done. And even though I was a big proponent for coaching, I was a healthy skeptic saying, "What? Not just does coaching work, but why does it work?" Mm. And there was limited amount of research, especially in those early days around coaching, because it had been such a nascent industry. And so the closest industry we could look to was counseling or psychotherapy, because there's a lot more robust research around this dynamic of two people going into a room trying to improve one's life. And how is that different from coaching? Not that different. I think there's a lot of similarities and a lot of overlap. So what we know within the research in counseling is that there's all sorts of different counselors with all sorts of different methodologies and modalities and theoretical backgrounds, et cetera. And what the researchers have asked is what makes the best counselors or the best psychotherapists across all of the different methodologies and theoretical backgrounds. And what they found out is that there's this thing that are sometimes referred to as common factors or interpersonal skills. It's a set of interpersonal skills that all the best counselors possess and use with all of their clients. And what it comes down to is I think there's really two main ingredients. The first is empathy. Mm. And it's easy to be empathetic when the person across the table looks like you, smells mm-hmm. like you, talks like you, has a background like you. And it's a lot different when that person is significantly different and also is maybe making choices and decisions that you don't necessarily agree with. And yet you still have to demonstrate empathy. It's that willingness and desire to put yourself in the other person's shoes. Mm. And then the second is what we call interpersonal responsiveness. So it's when there's some sort of a rupture threatening the alliance between the two people in the room, you can approach it in a constructive way. And you're not necessarily just getting defensive or pretending like it didn't happen. And so that skill is high in the best counselors. And when I say the best counselors, we're talking about this is measurable, right? The best counselors produce the best outcomes for their patients years down the road.
Yeah.
And so this skill set has been most accurately and tangibly identified by Tim Anderson out of Ohio University. And he developed an assessment called the FIS, the Facilitative Interpersonal Skills. And so what he was able to do is do some thin slicing. He demonstrated challenging interpersonal moments in counseling and therapy to students who were going into counseling programs. Mm. He had them record a video response. So he said, watch this challenging moment and then respond the way you think is most appropriate for the situation. And you recorded those responses and then coded them for 8 specific dimensions or 8 different sub-skills, if you will, of the facilitative interpersonal skills. And so he was able to tangibly identify people who had these skills, a very high level of these skills and low level of the skills, and it predicted outcomes years later with real live patients.
Wow.
So that's pretty cool. Like the fact that you can take, say, 4 minutes of video and have that predict how someone's going to perform years down the road with real live patients and clients. That's fascinating to me.
Yeah, that's incredible. Okay, so you said empathy was that first one. And then tell me again what the second one was. I want to make sure we have this like rock solid in our mind because this is so important.
Yeah, it's interpersonal responsiveness, or it's also known as alliance rupture repair responsiveness, which is maybe a little bit more tangible. Alliance rupture repair responsiveness.
Interesting. I mean, and it's another one of those points where you just want to pause and think about putting yourself in a difficult interpersonal situation. How have I responded in the past? Like how, because no one's comfortable, right? Let's just say it outright. Like no one feels great in those situations. So when you're put in a situation where you do feel that like ugh, level of discomfort interpersonally, how have you reacted?
Let me give you a very specific example.
Like yeah.
One of the videos that we use frequently in our training, the individual is looking into the screen, pauses for a second with this kind of concerned look on her face. And she says, so what you're saying is I'm a total bitch.
Ooh.
So you're the counselor. How do you respond to that?
Right.
Right. You can see the visceral response. Like, ooh, I didn't say that. You know, you might go into defensive mode.
Yeah.
Right. And so to maintain empathy in that moment, when some other person is accusing you of calling them a bitch, how do you respond in a productive manner? So that's that interpersonal responsiveness I'm talking about. There's a rupture there.
Yes.
The rupture is someone accusing you in that manner. And how do you respond? And so a poor response in that particular situation is one that becomes incredibly defensive.
Yeah.
No, that's not what I was saying. That sense of I have to defend myself. You're losing your empathy because you're falling into your own story, as opposed to saying, I'm sorry you feel that way. I'm sorry you feel that I'm calling you a bitch. And then so demonstrating some empathy and then being able to respond more productively. Let's talk about that a little bit more. Tell me a little bit more about what prompted you to say that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and what is embedded in that, call it better, more adaptive response that you just said, is this degree to which you're sort of subtly telling the other person, I believe you, that that's the impression that you have. Like, I believe that something about this felt that way. You know, you're not telling them, I don't believe you, prove it. And that right there ties so much back to what we've talked about a few moments ago, where if you have someone with a different background, you're not asking them to justify or prove or, you know, whatever, rationalize why they might feel the way they do. It's just a general understanding that, no, we're going to believe people when they come and say that something is difficult or that they're not getting along well in a particular situation, that's valid in and of itself, and let's understand why, but you don't have to prove to me that you have that feeling. And I think that in and of itself is a gift to give people in interpersonal situations, that I believe you, like you're valid in your feelings and in your interpretation. That doesn't mean we can't work to be in a better position, but you're valid.
Yeah. Very good point, April. And what we often say just internally is we talk about wanting to seek understanding before
yes.
being understood. And with a lot of the training that we offer, I think one of the constructs that we have to get really clear for people is that desire to seek understanding and say, your perspective is valid, not trying to invalidate it, not trying to prove it, force that other person to prove it to you, is, like you said, a gift. And I don't have to necessarily agree with everything you say.
Yeah.
Right? It's just, I just have to understand it. There just has to be room for your reality to exist in the space that we're working in. And I don't have to necessarily agree with everything. And you don't have to agree with everything I say or in all of my experiences either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can see, it's interesting. I can see where this would be so applicable. We're talking a lot about professional situations, but in the closest relationships in your life, do you have this level of psychological safety? And are you bringing these skills to those relationships, not just professionally with your coworkers or your teams or whatever, but with your spouse, with your friends, with, you know, your family members and other people, like people who work in organizations that you might volunteer for? I can see where that same empathy and then working to sort of repair would be so critical in just every relationship that we have. Yeah.
Especially those close ones, because I think we can often get into the doing of life and we forget, or we sort of assume we know the other person's experience.
Yeah.
And without really knowing.
Yeah, totally. And I think that's an important point to make, because of course, developing an environment or a relationship where there's a high degree of psychological safety is important for like a counselor or a coach. But increasingly, it's important in all of those relationships. And where you might, I can hear it already. There's someone listening, I promise, who is saying like, yeah, but I'm not good at that type of conversation, or I'm not good in conflict, or whatever the case may be. So this isn't for me. Like you mentioned training. How do you do this? Like, how do you work with somebody who maybe has the belief that like, no, I'm just not good in conflict, I'm not good with situations like that, and sort of, you know, bows out of the situation?
Well, it's so interesting, because I think, or when it comes to interpersonal skills, or say, I think they're often considered soft skills, which I think is a misnomer myself, because I think they're a lot more tangible than we give credit. We can identify what those interpersonal skills are. We have a list of 8 that we work with, right? And they can be practiced, they can be learned just like anything. What's so funny is that with our ideology and our thinking that I think is so pervasive in society, is that if I were to say to you, April, you know what, if you want to learn how to play the piano, I've got this great book and there's a fantastic YouTube video, you should watch it. Yeah. Are you going to become a better piano player with that alone?
Just by reading the book? I think probably not.
or even going to a concert. Oh, you should go and watch this amazing pianist at the concert next week. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
You're not going to become a great piano player. And yet we'll go to conferences and listen to speakers at the front of the stage when it comes to leadership development. We'll sit in a workshop for a day or two and we'll read books on how to become a better leader. And yet we don't take the same principles of deliberate practice into a domain such as leadership, such as interpersonal skills, such as how we communicate with other people. And mm-hmm. yet we can. And I think it starts with that growth mindset. I think you were pointing towards that, right? We need to first understand that these skills can be learned. You're not just naturally born with them, because to some extent, yes, some people have greater interpersonal skills than others. It's true. And yet that doesn't define your end point. That doesn't define how good you're going to get. And there's robust research in that area with violinists, the belief being the most talented violinists become the greatest violinists. That's not true. We know that the best violinists don't necessarily start off as being the best. They have the best practice regime. They practice the best. So they don't necessarily start as the best. And yet when you look at sports, you look at music, you look at all these other domains, then we know what those deliberate practice principles are, and we put them into practice a lot more readily. And we know, oh, well, I'm not good at basketball, but if I just keep practicing, I'll get better. Same thing with interpersonal skills. You can get better. You can practice. And we've developed the system in our training program to be able to do that.
That's amazing. You know, one of my favorite things about doing this podcast, the reason why I've done it for so long, the reason why I look forward to every conversation I have, is that more often than not, there is this moment, and it just happened, where I just get hit with a realization that I'm like, oh my God, I've never thought about it that way before. And this was one of them. So I can hear, again, I can anticipate someone who's listening to this saying, yeah, but it's really important. The way that I appear to my team is really important. So I'm going to go practice on my team and I'm going to be bad at this and I'm going to mess up and I'm not going to do a good job. And you're telling me to go and practice and mess up on my team. And here's the crazy thing that I just thought of. And I'm like, the reason why you feel uncomfortable showing up in front of your team and making a mistake is because you're not perceiving a level of safety there that allows you to make a mistake and get better at it. I mean, it is the issue at hand, right? It is the issue at hand. As that leader, what a great example to be able to say, hey guys, I'm working on something new. It's not something that historically I've had a lot of experience in. I'm going to fall on my face a few times. You are invited to help me grow in this space. I'm going to do my best and we're going to get through this. But like that meta moment of, oh my gosh, you want to create this psychologically safe environment. You don't feel like it's there. That's why you can't practice. It was just awesome. The way that you described it, it was just a really cool realization that I had never thought about in this space.
Yeah, that's so awesome. Setting the stage is so key. So especially if you're the leader, you get to set the stage for how you interpret failure, how failure is approached within your team. That is so amazing, right? To be able to say, I'm going to make mistakes. I'm the leader. And to be able to demonstrate vulnerability. I'm not perfect. I don't have all the answers. I'm working on X, Y, or Z. That is so critical as a leader. It instills confidence. It's ironic, or it's a paradox, perhaps is a better word, because in order to demonstrate confidence, sometimes you have to expose vulnerability. You have to expose your kryptonite, right? Well, this is my kryptonite. I'm not good at this. I'm working on it. I want to get better. And maybe there's even one step further besides setting the stage, which is asking for specific input. Like how am I doing with respect to this thing? What could I do better? And for a leader, often our belief is, I need to have all the answers. I need to call the shots. I need to know. And that's not the case. You don't have to know everything.
Yeah.
You don't have to have it right.
Yeah. I feel like Brene Brown's ears perked up when you made your point about vulnerability.
Yeah. There's one other point I wanted to mention there, April, just on that point with the training and practicing and practicing in front of your team. We find a middle ground. So we've developed software to help people practice these skills in a safe environment. We call it, it's like a flight simulator for interpersonal skills. So there is an in-between. So we can coach you on it. We can talk about the ideas and the concepts. And then you get to practice in this safe environment where you get feedback. And what's so amazing about the system is you can record your responses to various stimulus videos. So we have all these different scenarios within a team or one-on-one. And like that one, like, so what you're saying is I'm a bitch, right? Mm-hmm. You have these clips and then you practice responding and how you respond. And then you get feedback and you're getting feedback usually on one specific skill. So it's the skill of receiving feedback or giving feedback or asking an open-ended question, et cetera. Like these are the fundamental skills that everybody needs to learn. And you get to practice them one at a time, just the way you would sports, right? You don't just say, all right, go play a basketball game. No, you learn how to dribble, you learn how to shoot, you learn how to pass. And in a game, you put them all together. So in your team, that's kind of more like the game scenario. And yeah, you want to set the stage saying, I'm not going to be perfect. But you've also done this practice in the safe space and you've received feedback and then you've tried new things. So going into your team, you're not feeling totally vulnerable. There is some safety there, right?
That's great. I want something I don't want to miss in this conversation is there's two sides of the coin, both what's at stake and what we can gain. The importance of cultivating an environment that feels psychologically safe. And there's not a psychologist or a counselor out there that I've spoken to recently who's not completely inundated right now. We're in a tough situation just as a society, and you can point at any number of issues. There's plenty out there that are making this a very challenging time. And mental health and mental well-being are top of mind for a lot of people as a result of that. And I'm hoping, just because I don't want us to lose this opportunity to understand the link between psychological safety and mental well-being, the link between that and how people actually get along when they're in, and I don't mean get along with each other, but like get on with their lives in an effective way, or in a thriving way even, versus if they maybe don't have that. Can you talk a little bit about that link between basically what's at stake here? Why is this so important?
Well, one of the very first studies performed by Amy Edmondson out of Harvard was to look within hospital settings, the reporting of errors in administering drugs. So it's commonplace that within a hospital setting, the wrong drug or the wrong dosage will be administered to patients. Mm-hmm. And as you could imagine, you give the wrong dose to a patient, this is potentially life or death situation, right? So the question, or the hypothesis rather, that she had was that, and this is long before sort of the concept of psychological safety was really firmed up. And so she really had this belief that, or hypothesis that the best teams, the teams with the greatest level of teamwork would have the lowest number of reported errors. So she goes out, creates a study, collects data, starts doing the number crunching. And what does she find? That the opposite was true. The teams that reported the greatest degree of teamwork had the most number of errors. Now, April, why do you think that was the case? Why do you think that would be that way?
I mean, I think it goes back to the things you've been saying. Like, is it that there are more errors, or is it that they feel like they can say they've made an error?
Good job. Yes. So it wasn't the errors, it was the reporting of the errors.
Wow.
So teamwork correlated with the ability, the desire, and willingness to admit mistakes and report those errors. Whereas in environments where there's low teamwork, those got swept under the rug. And those are missed learning opportunities. And quite frankly, those are potentially, the death is potentially at stake here, right? Mm-hmm. And I believe if I'm not mixing up the research studies, this was done in a NICU, right? So this is in a neonatal intensive care unit where you have these little tiny preemies. And if you're administering the wrong dose, oh my goodness, right? This is really dramatic potential outcome of that situation. And now when you look a little more closely, like how did this happen? And there's examples of a nurse, it's 2 a.m, noticing on the charts that there's the wrong dosage administered. And then they think, well, I'm going to call the doctor. And the doctor, then she remembers, or he remembers, well, the last time I did this at 2 a.m, the doctor reamed me out and said, stay in your lane. I'm the doctor. Do your work. Remember, it is 2 a.m.
Yeah.
And so they don't pick up the phone. And what's the potential outcome? Death. So why am I telling this story? I'm telling this story because are we in the last couple of years with COVID and all of this global change, are we experiencing more stress and more mental health issues, or are we just reporting them? Or like, has society kind of embraced the concept of psychological safety where we can say, you know what? I'm not well and I need help. Whereas pre-COVID 2020-19, we just had to deal with that on our own, especially at work, right? Because work was work and home was home, and those two things didn't blend. But suddenly I was working and my cat's walking on my keyboard and my kids are playing in the background. And, you know, the work and home were the same thing because suddenly we had millions of people all working from home.
Yeah. Wow. That is such a good point. And it highlights just the scale of the issue, right? Like the scale of what, how important it is that we take this seriously, that we each take it upon ourselves to get better, strengthen the interpersonal skills that you talked about, make improvements in some of those most important relationships in our lives. Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is so helpful. You've mentioned a few times your program. As we're winding down, can you tell people where they can learn more about you, about this program? We've got quite a few professionals and just corporate folks who listen to this. And I think it is such a valuable, just a valuable resource for people to have. So can you point us in the right direction online?
Sure. So our corporate website for all of our psychological safety-based work is zarango.com. So Zarango.com. And for podcast listeners, we've put together an opportunity for folks to assess psychological safety within their team. So if you are part of a team and you're curious about how your team evaluates psychological safety, is it high, is it low, is it bimodal, do you have some people at one end, some people at the other end, you can stop guessing and you can find out, just measure it. And we can measure it relatively quickly and easily. And so there's a URL for that, which is /free PSI. PSI is Psychological Safety Index. So free PSI. And there's a form there for people to schedule an appointment with me or one of my colleagues. And we will administer that assessment for you. And we can also talk about the training and look at opportunities to offer that training. It is a 6-module training course. We call it Speak Up and Listen. Mm. And it can be delivered over 6 weeks or 12 weeks, depending on the cadence. And we could talk about that. There's more information about that on the website as well. So, and personally, if folks just want to connect with me, I'm reasonably active on LinkedIn and they can find me there. My URL is LinkedIn/S Wiedner. So my first initial for my first name, Stefan, and then my last name, Wiedner. So Wiedner. And I'd love to connect with folks there and follow along in the journey here.
Amazing. This has been so incredibly helpful. It's given me a lot to think about just in terms of how I interact with my team and in, you know, my personal relationships as well. And, you know, like we said at the start of our conversation, it's such an important topic for us all to be working on and aware of probably now more than ever. So I really appreciate you taking the time and being with us today.
It was an honor. Thank you so much, April.
All right, friends, hang out for just a minute. I've got a few more resources for you in case this or even some of the side paths that I kept us from going down to keep us a little bit more on track. But a few things that I want to make sure that I make you aware of after just a quick second. So stay with us and I'll be right back with a few more resources. All right, you guys, I really hope you enjoyed that conversation with Stefan Wiedner. I know I got a ton out of it. I mentioned partway through that I just made a connection to psychological safety that I had never thought about before. It was this like really cool meta moment. And hopefully you have those moments when you're listening to this podcast and we're talking to these experts. I mentioned it again in the conversation with Stefan, but it truly is one of the things I enjoy most about doing this work is getting to make connections like that, just mentally, that I'd never made before that helped me understand these topics on a much deeper level. A few things I want to make sure you know about. One, you know, we talked about the free assessment that Stefan's group has for you, so you can take your team through it. Really understand where your team is at in terms of their level of psychological safety. I've got a link to that in the additional resources below on this episode description and on the show notes page. So you can just click in if that's something that you're interested in. I've taken a peek. It looks like it could be a really great resource for you. So I would definitely suggest you take a peek at that. And then the other two resources that I wanted to share are two complementary podcast episodes. One of the episodes is about giving negative feedback, and the other episode is about receiving negative feedback. And I love these two episodes because they make you think about, you know, Stefan and I talked about some of those difficult interpersonal situations, you know, like the conflict ones that we all just hate and don't want to be in. Lots of times when we're in a professional setting, those come up around negative feedback. It's really hard to be the person on the side of the table who has to tell somebody a hard message, and it's really hard to be on the receiving end of that. So I've spent some time in two complimentary podcast episodes, one from the perspective of giving it, one from the perspective of receiving it, and we lean really hard on emotional intelligence and empathy. And that's why I wanted to connect it to this week's episode, because empathy was such a key piece in psychological safety that this is almost like the double click into it, right? Psychological safety is a much broader topic. How do we create a team experience that is safe for us to show up as our true selves and stumble and fall. But then the double click into that is when something does go wrong, or when we do have a hard message to deliver, how do we do that more effectively? So excited to give you guys those two podcast episodes. They are also linked below in the additional resources. I'm so thrilled that you joined me today. This topic was so interesting to learn more about. I hope you got something valuable out of it that you can take back and apply into your own life. And finally, let's remember that time is the most non-renewable resource on the planet, and I'm grateful to each and every one of you who chose to spend some of your precious time with me today. I'm Dr. April Seifert, and I'll see you next time.